It's time to catch the beat from Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign. And Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. As always on WEFT, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker, do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I am pleased to welcome to this week's show Brian Guerrero and Saad Shahab, both staff at the Siebel Center for Design at the University of Illinois. Together, you masterminded a week-long program for 20 high school students last summer, from freshmen to seniors, called Human-Centered Game Design. Brian, you come out of the College of Education, not programming, and so you are focused on that rather than the hardcore tech, and you are the K-12 liaison between Siebel Center and Illinois schools. Your research has explored the connection between video games and learning, focused on Minecraft as a jumping-off point to get students interested in astronomy, computer science, and data science. And Saab, as Associate Director of Assessment and Research at the Siebel Center, you work with undergraduate and graduate Siebel Center scholars studying the role of the teacher in STEM classrooms. So this really caught my interest. Brian and Saab, how would you describe this approach to game design to engage high school students with the seductive and compelling world of gaming and incorporate principles that are human-centered, focusing on emotional qualities such as empathy? And what specifically is human-centered design?
Yeah, let me start with the last question that you mentioned, which is what is human-centered design? So first of all, thank you for having us. This is an honor to be with you today. At the Siebel Center for Design, human-centered design for us is a creative problem approach that relies heavily on two key constructs, which are empathy and iteration. We believe in the need to connect with everybody who might be related directly or indirectly to a certain problem at hand, and be kind to them, connect with them, learn from them, in order to start forming those productive teams that can collaborate and work together and iterate together until we arrive to a creative, meaningful, and relevant solution. So we believe at Siebel Center for Design that everybody can be a design thinker. Everybody can use human-centered design and design thinking as creative problem-solving approaches that are very flexible yet systematic and allows for creative thinking, allows for relationships to nurture, allows for very thoughtful and meaningful ideas to rise. And that's why we believe that there is a space and a place for human-centered design in every discipline on campus and in the K-12 world, because we think what's better than preparing the future generation to address challenges using human-centered design, despite the type and the nature of the challenge. And that's why we love to bring human-centered design to K-12 education. And Brian and his team has been doing a fantastic job in bringing human-centered design to K-12. One of the many projects that he's working on is the K-12 camp, or the summer camp, that he designed and led with a bunch of team members as well. They were phenomenal. And I'm gonna throw it back at Brian to talk a little bit about the summer camps in general and how they brought human-centered design to game design in that camp in particular.
First of all, Cope, I want to thank you so much for actually mentioning that I come from education and I don't really come from this programming background. And that is one of those challenges, but also one of those opportunities that I really wanted to hone in on this camp. I actually employed a lot of human-centered design when thinking about what should go into this camp. And in order to do that, I tried to talk to as many people that have either taken some game design courses at here. I know some students from DePaul. I've got someone who is employed at a pretty big game industry in California. I talked to high school students, or high school teachers, to see what is part of their curriculum. And some of the things that I found, some of the insights were that a lot of these game design classes tend to be very programming focused. And I need to go into this with this idea of, I don't know who my students are before I teach this camp. I don't know how much programming skills they're going to come with. I don't even know how much like typing skills they're going to have when they walk in through that door. I've got my own assumptions and I've got my own biases, but I can't really rely on those. So I knew that this needed to be an opportunity where I put programming on the side and I really focus on that empathy, human-centered design perspective. So I found that when I talked to some of those previous students that were in game design courses, there's not much talk about the user themselves, who we're designing for. How do we design something that's fun for them? How do we know whether something is too frustrating or too difficult? So that ended up being a big part of that. Having students, one, giving them this opportunity to explore all these different game genres and opportunities and experiences that they might not have experienced. And two, still letting them create something digitally that does not require them to come in with a lot of programming experience. I found something very useful for that. I found something that let them make essentially old Game Boy games. So I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Game Boy. You don't need to focus too much on the visuals of it. You don't need to focus too much on making some beautiful orchestrations. You just focus on making something fun and enjoyable. And that was a really powerful moment when I realized that a lot of these students were having a lot of fun actually creating this. And when I tried to get them to take a break to say, hey, let's take like a 15-minute break. You guys have like programming or not programming, but you've been designing for hours. Let's go upstairs and let's play some video games. It was so hard to pull them upstairs for that 15 minutes to play Mario Kart. They just wanted to stay down. So I had to pull people one at a time. So I felt better about giving them breaks. But that felt really powerful because it felt like they had spent all this time thinking about the process, going through design thinking tools, thinking about their users, and they just wanted to start creating.
You used GB Studio. I don't know if it's called that or if it's called Game Boy Studio, which is free software. And so that allows users to create working classic Game Boy games. And so it makes game development accessible to all the participants, regardless of their technical background. And also, they can go back home. They don't have to pay for expensive software. So, how was that part of your planning for this course?
That was such a big part because that was one of the big discussions that I had with my other instructor. I was asking, well, what should we use? Do we want to use Godot? Do we want to use some of the other game engines? And we ultimately just stuck with GB Studio because it felt like it would be the most approachable, easy to use, easy to access. And a lot of my students ended up going beyond what I was expecting them to do, which is perfect because it was a very easy to use, very approachable software, as you mentioned. So students went beyond what my curriculum was going to teach them and were essentially teaching each other, helping each other. And that's that sort of collaboration that we want to see within these human-centered design projects.
Now, how did you recruit your students? I noted that this camp was a collaboration with the Worldwide Youth in Science and Engineering program at Granger College of Engineering, and it's designed to introduce talented and diverse pre-college students to active college students, and together they explore engineering and the sciences. And it also offers opportunities to students from underrepresented populations. Who were your students and how did you recruit them?
We work through WISE, which is that acronym that you mentioned that I can't name the full thing. They're a fantastic group to work with because we're not the only camp that's running at this time. There's actually maybe throughout the summer, I want to say there's like 15 to 20 different STEM related camps just out of here. So they offer these commuter camps, but then they also offer these residential camps This camp specifically was a residential camp, which meant that students were given this opportunity to not just attend this camp, but they were actually also staying within the dorms with counselors that were recruited through WISE to sort of give them a more, thorough experience throughout. I'm always surprised where these students come from. We always expect students to be from Illinois, just something local and easy to be able to travel here. But we also had some students from California, and we also had one student that came from China, which I was like, oh my God, now the pressure's really on. I really want to feel like you're walking out of this with, something worthwhile. But it was really nice because one of the first activities that we did early on was, as I mentioned, I don't know anything about these students. They don't know anything about me. So I wanted to just learn, what does everyone play? What sort of games have everyone experienced? And then after that, I had everyone write down post-it notes. I want to say every student wrote down like 5 to 10 different post-it notes, and we put them up on the board, and we tried to find these common patterns. And it was just wonderful seeing all these different shared experience. And I could see right there on day one that a lot of connections and friendships were being made, were being formed just from being like, oh, you played this? I love that game. Let's talk more about this. Or when we get back to our dorm, do you want to like play this game? And that was fantastic because even though they were coming from all these different places, they still had this shared thread, this love and passion for these different games.
I also found it in the article I read about your camp very interesting that in planning this, you spoke with industry professionals to understand what content they had learned during their academic years. So you really, this was a comprehensive research effort. How did you really come to plan such a wide scope?
Honestly, through human-centered design, it's through the process, through the taxonomy that we really like to encourage. I came into this with a human-centered design problem of how might I design this comprehensive program of game design class without having this programming aspect. So I looked at my connections. I thought about some other stakeholders that I could talk to that could provide some insight. And luckily, I did have those connections of either friends from college, friends that I grew up with. They were just willing to share that experience and share what really stuck to you. And now that you're working in game industry, what do you feel like you missed? What was more important that they spent like a second on that you feel like needs to be addressed? And a big part of it was that person factor, that human factor, that who am I designing for? In a lot of these classes, college students are often just designing some sort of game. And it's just for the class. It's just for the grade. In reality, you're often thinking about a particular audience. You're often thinking like, how do I design this to teach something? That became one of those driving factors, and it fits so well into that human-centered design piece of, oh, we felt like we missed a lot of empathy in thinking about like the design. So the two kind of just felt really well together.
Do you think any games that were designed during this camp have a life outside of it?
During the last day, it's a wrap up. All the parents show up. I do some presentations. We give out awards, and I drop my contact info. And usually, I sort of expect the contact info just to fall into the void. I was not expecting three different groups to contact me afterwards to say, "Hey, I'm still working on this project," or, "Hey, can you send me this file or this image that I made?" And I think some of those groups are actually still working on that today. They're still asking me for advice in terms of like, do you have any ideas on like, oh, I want to make something that's based on Norse mythology, and I'm thinking of this kind of game. Dr. Guerrero, do you have any ideas of like what could be some good inspiration, some things that we can look at to sort of build upon this? Do you have any resources that I can give to some of the people that are working on this project with me because they weren't at this camp, and I want to be able to teach them a little bit about the process that we used. So I'd like to think that some of these games are either they're going to keep making some of these, because as you mentioned, it's free to work on, and it's also free to put up on some websites. There's a website called itch.io, which is really, really developed for like the indie game scene. You could just go up there and put it on there. If they make something good enough, they could even charge like $5, $10 for it. And they love that. They love that inspiration that I feel like is very much missed of the industry is very scary to work in. But there's so many inspirational stories of one person making a game that sells millions. And I think a lot of them love that idea of, oh, I can make something and I can make something successful. And I don't need to work at a game, like a large game studio. I just need to start making something.
Now, why do you say that it's scary to work in game design these days?
Most of the industry tends to be a little volatile right now. I think that's the most terrifying part. If you look up online, there tends to be a lot of just mass layoffs, essentially. And this happens to some of the really biggest game industries, big game companies. A game doesn't do well, they lay off people. A game does really well, they'll lay off people. So I still want to encourage students to sort of explore this, but I want to be able to equip them with the ability to do all of it. And that's why GB Studio was fantastic, because they could do the art, they could do the music, they could think about all these different aspects as a group without needing hundreds and thousands of people to work on it.
And is AI a threat to human game designers?
I think it really depends. I think there's always that fear of you could just have AI do everything, and that removes the need to sort of talk to people. You could just ask ChatGPT, hey, come up with these ideas that people need right now. And those might end up missing some of the aspects that you're going to get from actually talking to people. I think AI does a really good job to sort of come up with initial ideas and creativity, but I still think you need to go out there and physically have conversations with people, meet people, bring them in for feedback and responses. I think there's a lot of opportunities that AI cannot replace, but I think it can be as a, I think it can be used as a very useful tool for some of the initial planning.
To ask both of you about the larger scope of what's happening at Siebel Center for Design. It hasn't been going very long. What is it? 3, 4 years? What are other projects you're involved with? Because you're both on staff at Siebel Center. Tell me a little bit more about what's happening.
First of all, to state our missions, the mission of the center is to practice, model, and teach design thinking using human-centered design to reimagine our campus, community, and collective world. So, as you said, Cope, like we like to see ourselves as a resource, campus resource, community resource, world's resource, if I want to dream big here, where we can work together on spreading human-centered design and design thinking, because we dream of a world of collaborative problem solvers, interdisciplinary teams working on the current challenges and try to come up with relevant and creative solutions to these challenges. And for that, we have tried and been trying since like 2021. The gates of the building were open, but there's lots of work that was happening behind the scenes since 2018, led by our director, Rachel Switsky, and again, towards serving that mission and vision that I stated. And for that, we have been working a lot in trying to develop and implement and evaluate research-supported programs that fit everybody, whether you are a faculty member, a community member, a K-12 member, a student, of course, on campus. If you go to our website, designcenter.illinois.edu, you will find something for you. So we're working on lots of programs ranging from course offerings, of course, to workshops that you can request, to professional development that you can request, to retreats that you can request. And what's nice about all of these offerings, that they share one thing, which is human-centered design as a key framework and mechanism and engine that people learn about in order to start applying it to their area of expertise or area of content. That's what we do. And for the K-12 in particular, we have a very interesting initiative that Brian and I have been working on for a while now, and we thankfully succeeded to launch in April 2025, which is this year actually, which is the Human-Centered Schools Network. So this is a network that we want to have accessible and available for anybody in Illinois and outside Illinois interested in bringing human-centered design to their K-12 world, whether they are administrators or teachers or educators. they will find something also in this network for them. They will connect with other members in Illinois, outside Illinois, public, private schools, and they will share resources and thoughts and interests about human-centered design and how to teach it and how to bring it to the K-12 classroom. We hosted our first annual summit last April, and we are planning to host another, hopefully, annual summit this upcoming April.
The big goal of this is essentially to get human-centered design in schools. Whether it's teachers using human-centered design to sort of reimagine some of their lessons to be more effective with their students by getting feedback from their students, learning about how to integrate other ideas to sort of resonate more with what matters to the students there, or, which is my personal favorite, reimagining some of their lessons that they're teaching so that they integrate some sort of human-centered design project that students are trying to solve. To give you a good example, we're currently working with Uni High, one of our early adopters. They've been fantastic. And I've been working with the art teacher very closely, Lisa Evans. She's fantastic, integrating human-centered design projects in her art class and in her design class. And in one of those projects, what we're looking to do is we're thinking about this project of how might we bring more pollinators to our local community? If we were to tackle this problem in like a non-human-centered design way, me and you probably have ideas already. We probably have a, let's just build a garden. Let's build a big community garden. And that would be it. That's the end of the project. But by integrating more human-centered design through this, we're going through these five separate phases through our human-centered design taxonomy, where students are trying to understand more about, well, what is the actual problem that's going on here? If we were to do a garden, does that really fix an underlying problem here? Let's talk to community members. Let's talk to people in some of the park associations. Let's talk to some experts at the university to learn more about, well, what is the underlying issue here? Let's synthesize that information and then let's come up with as many ideas as possible. Let's do some low, really easy, simple, low fidelity prototypes, and then let's try these out. It's a very transformative process so that the students are taking the subjects of what they're learning in their classes, whether it's art, whether it's science, whether it's math, whether it's English, whether it's social studies, and trying to apply it in a context that helps create a solution for someone.
And we have the first ever Museum of Pollination in our community, which is a quite wonderful thing. I worked closely with May Barenbaum and some of the staff there. When I was at the University Press doing book design, we designed a honey cookbook to help them raise money. So, pollination, you get my attention.
This is perfect. And this is why I do human-centered design, because now this is an important resource that I can bring back to Lisa and be like, hey, I didn't realize this was here. This would be a fantastic person to bring in to the class, have
Absolutely.
students learn a little bit more about like why is this important? We all have our assumptions, we all have our biases on why we think this is working, why we think it's not working, why it's important, why people don't like it. And it's so important to get all those different perspectives before we start cooking.
Have you been able to get any involvement from teachers in the local public schools? Uni is a wonderful school, but it is for the higher level kids and it's university centered. And there has been a difficult relationship between local public schools and the university because university classes will go in, do a project, then they're gone. They get their research, and the teachers feel like, hey, wait, we need bigger connections with the universities.
Cop, you're just pointing at the whole purpose behind establishing the Human-Centered Schools Network. Because you just said the center is, in my opinion, still considered in its infancy. Like, we're kind of like 4 years now, 5 years old, but the whole initiative of spreading our work into the K-12 world happened like from the early on, but it wasn't until we got some people like Brian and previously Gail Rost and others. I don't want to forget anybody, but these were the people who helped us start thinking about how can we bring this into more than just like few schools who can like afford working with us or have the resources? Like, how can we spread even to more schools, to public schools, all of that stuff? So we are hoping that the launch of the Human-Centered Schools Network webpage, which is in its final stages of development now, will help us get some interest from people in the spaces that you talked about, and will set us up to start connecting them with folks like schools we're working with in Chicago. Nutter High School, for example, is another example. But that was kind of like the thinking. We needed like first a network that can help connect teachers with other teachers and start that interaction and exchange of resources and thoughts to bring human-centered design not only to one or two schools, but hopefully more than those schools into the public schools for sure.
You hit the nail right on the head. I think one of my worries has always been I don't want to go into a school, do research, and then leave. I want to be able to develop some sort of partnership or some sort of connection. A big part of this network is being able to, one, offer resources to teachers, being able to offer an area where we can share teacher stories on what they've implemented in their classes. That way, we can connect other teachers with each other to gather and build inspiration from what other teachers are doing in their classes. And the other thing is, we like to work with a school and establish what we call as a HCD core. It's essentially a group of teachers that we work with very closely that essentially become experts at that school around human-centered design. We try and teach them as much as we know to provide them as much as support as we can. That way, if that partnership ever does not exist, they still have that foundation of that core still there. We don't know what's going to happen next year. We don't know what's going to happen the year after that. So I always go in making sure that this group of teachers becomes the experts there and they bring in new teachers and they become the ones that teach everyone there. It's not just the school's reliant on SCD to be the proprietors of human-centered design knowledge. It's we want to be able to equip other teachers with the ability to do this as well, while us being there for support if needed.
I want to thank the teachers, honestly, that has been working with us over the past couple of years, allowing us to think about bringing human-centered design to K-12 education and K-12 classrooms and coming up or testing models that really work. And teachers has been like so creative, so amazing, as always, in coming up with different ways to bring this to their classroom, and also inspiring us and inspiring our content that has been feeding into our own programs like the camp and other stuff.
What I want to mention is we do have a webpage for our Human Schools Network. So if there are any educators out there that are interested or they want to learn more about this, they're able to sort of just dip their toe in and sign up for that. We're starting to think more about approaching this from a human-centered design background again, of how could we get more teachers to sort of jump into this and maybe join do some of our workshops. So we're trying to learn more about, well, what can help motivate some of the Champaign-Urbana teachers to do this and bring this to their classroom. So I think currently we're trying to explore maybe looking at adding professional development hours to some of this, but we would love to hear more insights from any teachers on how you think this can help resonate with our community.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. I give a hearty thanks to Brian Guerrero and Saad Shahab for a look inside their program for high school students on human-centered game design at the Siebel Center for Design. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. With my thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
This is WEFT.